What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
What's up, guys? Red Nation News Podcast. My name is Salman Ali at Red Nation Hoops on Twitter. You're joined by Forrest Walker at Do Not on Twitter. How you doing, man?
Pretty good. I'm enjoying having some free time.
Yeah, I am too, especially the last 48 hours. Man, I don't even know where to start. I think we kind of have to start with Colangelo's story because I think it's easily the craziest story of the entire NBA season. And that's saying something. We've had Tunnelgate earlier this year with the Rockets and Clippers. J.R. Smith threw soup at a Cavs coach. A bunch of stuff happened, and this one tops all of it.
It's like the Kevin Durant thing, but even more, which is amazing.
This one might have real repercussions. The Kevin Durant thing didn't matter. It's not going to affect anything. Nobody cares that Kevin Durant has burner accounts except for NBA Twitter. This might affect actual decision making.
Yeah. It is pretty wild, right? That Colangelo, if this is true, he's probably going to lose his job.
Yeah, so we should probably explain what happened. So The Ringer put out a report by Ben Diedrich, very detailed. It's a little long, but you can get through it in about 15, 20 minutes if you have the time. It's well worth your time. I promise you, it's well worth your time. Apparently, a source tipped him off in a few months ago, basically. And this source was anonymous. It was basically a Twitter egg. And this Twitter egg also reached out to him on Instagram. So on these two platforms, he reached out to this reporter, who's pretty deeply embedded in the Philly community. Like, Ben Diedrich is a big Philly guy, and a noted Brian Colangelo critic. So if there's someone to leak the story to, it's this guy, basically. And basically what happened is this guy claimed to work with artificial intelligence, AI, and had discovered something unusual. He discovered these five Twitter accounts that were indisputably linked by their likes, their mentions, the way they spoke, who they followed, just patterns in the way these Twitter accounts were made, everything about them were, there's no doubt in this guy's mind that the same person was behind it all. And what this guy was alleging was that it was Brian Colangelo. The general manager of the 76ers apparently had five burner accounts, according to this guy, and was sitting on them and was tweeting out these reckless things, like really reckless things. Like, he was tweeting about Joel Embiid, Markel Fultz, defending himself, defending Brian Colangelo and his shirt collars. Like everything about Brian Colangelo he was defending, and he was defending moves that the organization made after Brian Colangelo was put in power. He was criticizing Sam Hinkie and Masai Ujiri. He was doing all sorts of reckless stuff, this account. And this person had tipped off to Ben Diedrich that it was Brian Colangelo. And so Ben Diedrich reaches out to the Sixers, and he asks for comment. And immediately after, and Ben did something really smart. He only revealed two of the accounts, right?
So that was a stroke of genius. Well done, Ben.
Yeah, he only revealed two of the accounts, so as to monitor the other three accounts as soon as he reaches out to these guys. So he reaches out to Sixers PR basically about this story, and it's kept under wraps. Like nobody knew. Like while this is going on, nobody knows that Ben's doing this. And I think it was really smart on his end to keep on collecting evidence. So he reaches out to Sixers PR and he asks them about these two accounts. And Sixers PR gets back to him like later, like a few days later, after talking to Brian Colangelo. And in that time, all five accounts are private, turned private. So there's no doubt in like anyone's mind that whoever he reached out to, like that was a domino effect, man. Like he struck a nerve by pointing this out, and whoever received info clearly did not want this to be released and turned all these accounts to private. But like Ben here was keeping track of all this. Like he still had those three accounts in his back pocket. And so, by the way, this has nothing to do with the Rockets, but I'll leave annotations.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I'll leave annotations in the comment section or the description of this podcast where you can skip forward. But whatever, I'll get back to the story. So basically, these accounts are all turned private, and apparently, the Sixer staffer had only talked to Brian Colangelo. Nobody else in the organization knew about this. Only Brian Colangelo, and so. I mean, it's pretty logical to say that he had something to do with those accounts being turned private. Whether he told someone, whether he himself turned them private, or whether he's definitely involved. Like that much is confirmed at this point. And so, monitoring these accounts' behaviors, Ben found out that these accounts were following like. They were following Brian Colangelo's son's high school team. They were following like really personal, like friends and family of Brian Colangelo. Like, there's no doubt that this person knew at least knew Brian Colangelo very well.
Yeah, there was a bunch of things that nobody who wasn't Brian Colangelo would want to follow. Right. Like people that have only like 50 followers that he knows personally, and like all the accounts follow them and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So like these accounts were without a doubt linked to Brian Colangelo now. Like that much is confirmed. And Twitter has done like some crazy things in the past 48 hours. Like we've got some real Sherlock Holmes here on Twitter. Like we have some real detectives here. Like they've dug up stuff on these three accounts. Like they're all linked. Someone tried to log into these accounts, and Twitter, you know, when you try to log into an account that's not yours and you enter the wrong password, they're gonna ask you for a confirmation email, a confirmation phone number. And so all those phone numbers end in the digits 91. So the same person operates all three of these accounts. And what's come out now is that it might be Brian Colangelo's wife, which is just insane. Like, it blew my mind. The story is still developing.
It keeps getting weirder, yeah.
Yeah, like, it might be Brian, like, and, like, there were all these, like, linguistic patterns that match up to someone who speaks Italian as their primary language and English as their secondary language. Like, look, Twitter dug all this up. Like, this is not me, like, analyzing this. This is Twitter. They dug all this up. I love this app. I love this stupid app so much. And so, like, there's now a contingent of people, and I'm not sure where I fall on this, but there's a lot of people that are starting to believe that this is Brian Colangelo's wife. And whatever the case may be, Brian Colangelo right now, like, the Sixers just came out this morning and said they're going to do a full-on investigation of this report. Yeah. Whatever the case may be, Brian Colangelo is in some deep hot water right now.
Yeah, because either it's him and that's a total nightmare and he's going to get fired for it, or it's like his wife or dad or a combination or something, and that's just as bad, right? Like, there's a bunch of sensitive information that has been being spread by these accounts that should not be getting out to the public. So even if this is not him, that means someone very close to him is getting information from him. So it's not great. It's not great for him, but it's great for all of us who just want to see chaos happen. And I want to put something out there. I've seen a bunch of people saying, like, why would this rich and powerful guy want to do this? Why would he put himself in this dangerous situation just to yell at some people for being mad online? Man, being mad online is what rich and powerful guys do. That's, we have seen so many times, and we should know beyond the shadow of a doubt, that once you have money and power, the only thing you want is for other people to not call you names. And they will go to any length just to, like, stand up for themselves and call people haters and crap like that.
Right, like, this idea that a rich and powerful person could be this insecure shouldn't be news to anyone. Like I'm not going to get into specifics, but over the last 2 to 3 years, like, this shouldn't be breaking news that someone of this power could do something like this, could be this insecure online, and care so much about his public persona. Like, this shouldn't be at all news to anybody. Yeah, but, like, this story right now, like, it's easily one of the five greatest things in NBA Twitter history. Like, this is, like, this up there with Tunnelgate, this is up there with the DeAndre Jordan story, like, where, like, the Clippers had kidnapped DeAndre Jordan and locked him into a house in downtown Houston, and there were all these conflicting reports about Mark Cuban driving around downtown Houston looking for DeAndre Jordan's address. Like, this is up there with all those great nights on Twitter. And, like, I just, this is great. Now, we should probably explain to listeners why it's not surprising that an executive would have a burner account in the first place. Like, this goes back decades, like, before Twitter. Pretty much ever since the internet has been a thing, team personnel has monitored their perception online and fan bases through message boards, Facebook groups, blogs, and now Twitter. Like, a good example of this in the pre-Twitter age is, like, Clutch Fans. Like, teams have had people in the organization checking the temperature of the fan base through sites like Clutch Fans, and sometimes they would even post stuff. Like, every Twitter account with a good amount of followers has burner accounts from the specific team that they cover monitoring everything that they say. Like, this is just a known thing. Like, media members know this already, right? Like, if you don't believe me, like, I would advise you to listen to, like, Jeff Van Gundy on an interview or a broadcast whenever he goes on one of those rants about the media. Like, more often than not, he's referencing Twitter without saying Twitter. Like, someone like Jeff Van Gundy 100% has a burner account. Coaches do it. Executives do it. It's not new. Everyone knows about it. It's just the way things are.
Yeah, one day we'll figure out who Daryl Morey's burner account is. It's probably the most. It's probably the most boring account on the entire website.
Yeah. See, like, people like Daryl Morey, Danny Ainge, and like executives that are public like that and have like have their own Twitter account and like are willing to do radio interviews and willing to do podcasts and willing to do all that stuff. And reach out to their fan base. Like, those guys, like, aren't insecure at all. Like, they're public with their crap. Like, they're pretty confident in themselves, and they're smart about being out there. And, like, there's no doubt in my mind that, like, there are executives, like, on the internet. Like, every executive has some sort of Twitter presence on the internet. That's just the way things are. Like, and it'd be, frankly, a dumb thing not to, because you have to keep track of this stuff, especially in, like, free agency and like the buyout market, and like, you know, you have to monitor what teams are thinking, what the rumors, all that stuff. Yeah, it's just a smart thing to do. Twitter's just one way to get information that everybody has.
Yep, but they don't all go on internet calling people dips and telling people that this is a normal caller, find a new slant.
Yeah, so the thing is, these burner accounts usually don't say anything. Like,
they just lurk.
Yeah, they just make the account, keep track of things said about their team, follow loved ones, and stay dormant. That's what they do. Like, that's what makes this story so fascinating. It's that the allegations is Brian Colangelo was so insecure to make a burner account, tear down players on his own team, tear down Sam Hinkie and Masai Ujiri, and defend himself online. Like... This story is
It's so good.
It's awesome. And right now, as we're speaking, there's been a new allegation that Brian Colangelo apparently has like a blog post account or something. Like,
yeah, on one of like it's on like the on the Sixers like SB Nation or something, right?
Yeah, like, it's like some sort of SB Nation account where like he comments on Sixers blogs and Raptors blogs, like, and this time period lines up to where Eric Jr., one of the burner accounts, was tweeting almost on a daily basis. Like, this story is nuts. This story is nuts. It has everything. So many layers. And I just love that NBA Twitter is, like, discovering new details about this. By the hour, like, there are things learned today that, like, just weren't available yesterday through investigative. I'm not even sure if it's reporting. It's just lurking. It's just, like, being a sleuth and just, like, and just going through, like, using your free time to just find links, find stuff said, and, like, I just, this is great. I love this. Like, this is why I hate when people say Twitter is, like, this bad thing for society or whatever. Like, maybe it is, but it's just so fun. Like, who cares if it is? Like, who cares if it's a damaging place to be? Like, it's just the best. NBA Twitter is awesome. Like, and like this story is just another example of why it's so fun.
Yeah, NBA Twitter is amazing. The NBA is amazing. The characters and storylines, as it were.
This league is the best.
It's better than any soap opera, man. Like, it's best. You can't script this stuff. Even
this stuff
if it feels
doesn't
like
have.
Sometimes.
Yeah, this, you're right. It does often feel like it's scripted. This stuff does not happen in the NFL. This stuff does not happen in the MLB. Like, they're arguing about completely different stuff. Like, they're arguing about flag protests and all that BS, right? Like players in their league are protesting about important causes and kneeling for stuff that they feel is justified. And the NFL is, like, fining players for kneeling next year or whatever. And in this league, like, it's just the total opposite. Like, players are free to express themselves. Players are free to protest about anything they want. Players are free to talk about anything they want. Be characters. Joel Embiid is the best. Like, through all this, Joel Embiid was tweeting, like, last night. Like he was tweeting at these burner accounts, man. Like, he tagged one of the burner accounts, and he liked everything said about him on these burner accounts. Like, this is amazing.
Yeah, it's the biggest problem the NBA has. They have two big problems right now, which can be summed up as... is this hilarious storyline too salacious and enjoyable? And is this NBA team too good? So I think they're doing okay.
Yeah. I 100% believe Brian Colangelo played some part in this. Like, there's no way that this sensitive info gets out there without Brian Colangelo somehow being involved. He either told his wife and she tweeted it from these burner accounts, or he tweeted himself because he's really insecure about his image.
Yeah, I don't care either way, but I choose to believe it. I absolutely choose to believe this is real.
He's losing the public opinion battle, like the already. Either way, the fact that these accounts immediately became private as soon as the Sixers questioned about it leads straight back to Colangelo. I think he's gone. Like, I don't see how they could possibly bring him back, even if this was just his wife tweeting these things.
Yeah, except so that's probably the case, but then. What happens then? What if they hire David Griffin?
I mean, this all leads back to LeBron, right?
Yep. All roads lead to LeBron in this league.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going to get into LeBron later in this podcast. But right now, I just want to say, like, the league brought in Jerry Colangelo to... I mean, they basically brought him in to prevent a situation like this from happening. Like,
yes, they thought that it looked bad. The optics were poor. Well, yeah,
they brought him in because they thought the optics of Sam Hinkie were poor. Well, now I have some news for you, Adam Silver. This right here is one of the most like whatever the Sixers PR is scrambling right now. And like, I was never a fan of Brian Colangelo. Like when Jerry Colangelo brought him in, I just thought it was the most obvious display of nepotism I've ever seen. Like, it was just so blatant, And it was just, it undercut Sam Hinkie like crazy. And Sam Hinkie was forced to resign before he was fired because everybody knew the hammer was going to come down eventually. And I thought it was the shadiest thing. And I thought the NBA was wrong to get involved. And this is like a form of like redemption, a form of like payback. Like Sixers fans are rejoicing right now.
Yeah, they are sick of this, and it looks like that sickness is the fever's breaking.
Yeah.
As you said, who could have predicted this would happen? That that this nepotism and like, I guess, sort of old school manly man mentality would cause a problem. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that Sam Hinkie was perfect and yada yada. There's plenty of debates about what Sam Hinkie was doing, and I don't care to relitigate any of that stuff.
And listen, I'm a process truther, so I'm going to defend Sam Hinkie till the end. But you're right, he isn't perfect. Like he made mistakes. He wasn't so forthcoming with the media as he should have been. But
he didn't do this.
Yeah, he didn't do this. This is the story so great.
The funniest outcome possible would be if Sam Hinkie came back on. That'd be the funniest.
You think he would come back?
I don't care if he would or not. I'm just saying it would be the funniest possible outcome.
It absolutely would. For an ownership group to swallow, it's probably like that. That would be like, it's just,
I mean, if they did, the fan base would just rejoice, right? They would just absolutely party.
I mean, I think they're already doing that right now, man. Like, I think, like, they hate Brian Colangelo. They hate the Colangelos and everything they stand for because of the shadiness in the way the NBA brought him in and undercut Sam Hinkie. Like, and the way that they've, frankly, made decisions over the past 2 years. Like, the Markel Fultz trade doesn't look great. The trade they made earlier this year for Trevor Booker doesn't look great. Brian Colangelo hasn't done the best job. He's made a couple smart signings, like, you know, signing JJ Redick, signing Marco Bellinelli, signing Ilyasova. Like those were smart signings, but like on the whole, he hasn't done the best job, and the fan base hates him. Like the fan base hates these guys. Like they just. So let's move on to the Rockets. I'll leave something in the description so you guys can forward this part if you don't care about this. But I'm sure there are some people who wanted to hear our takes on this. So how are you feeling now that you've had a couple of days to digest the end of the season?
It was a successful season. I think that it was a successful season in that it did everything we hoped and more. Contextually, in the moment, it feels like a loss because it was a loss and this was a legit chance to get a championship. But I think that big picture, this has increased Houston's stock around the league and around those who cover the league. And if you can choose to either run this thing back from before the season or get this outcome, I actually think that you probably just go ahead and take this outcome. Because this is better than anyone expected this RS season.
Yeah, I'll say this. There's going to be a lot of what ifs from this series for years to come. Like, what if Chris Paul never got hurt? What if Luka Mbamute was 100%? What if they didn't miss 27 straight threes in Game 7? What if they caught a more favorable whistle in Game 6 and 7? Whatever the case, I don't think you can point to anything the Rockets did or didn't do as a reason they didn't win this series. Like, James Harden played hard as hell. His three ball just wasn't falling. Mike D'Antoni coached a hell of a series. I couldn't really find anything to nitpick him on. Chris Paul played his ass off until he pulled his hammy. PJ Tucker was a monster. The Rockets did everything in their power to push this series as long as it ended up going. It really looked like they had the Warriors shook with their defense, and they just didn't catch any breaks.
Yeah, I mean, the 27 missed three-pointers thing.
That really hurt you. That really hurt you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cosmic joke, honestly. And a lot of people have been arguing over, like, well, you got to go to something else, which might have been true during the early part of that stretch, right? Some of the – if I looked at the video of all the missed threes in a row, the earlier ones, a lot of them were kind of contested. They were just kind of throwing up threes. But as it progressed pretty quickly, they were wide open. There were tons of wide open threes. And look, the fact of the matter is that if you are passing up wide open threes, you've already lost.
Yeah, like a lot of those, a lot of those threes came within the flow of their offense. I agree. Like a lot of those looks are looks they got during the regular season and made like pretty regularly. Like they were a 36% 3-point shooting team or something like that. Like they were, you know, looks they should have made, and they just missed them. I mean, they just flat out missed them. And part of it could be like they were just tired. Like they play that entire rotation played a ton of minutes by the end of it, and they looked exhausted. And they certainly played hard on defense, but on offense you could tell maybe the tired legs got to them, and the shooting was a result of that. Part of it was, you know, I just think that it was kind of like after that first half, like their energy just kind of wasn't there in the same way offensively that it was in the first half. Maybe it was because the Warriors really amped up their defense. Like the Warriors started to play up on the Rockets in that second half. Like it was pretty noticeable. Like the energy the Warriors showed in that first half was pretty embarrassing. Like Kevin Durant didn't even try to get rebounds in that first half. And in the second half, like the Warriors had a noticeable spike in energy. And maybe that affected the Rockets. Maybe they just weren't expecting that energy to come. And maybe they were expecting to play that same Warriors team for the first half. I don't know. Like, we'll never know.
They were saying, like, it's 1 in 100,000 chance or whatever. I think even if you adjust for fatigue, even if you adjust for, like, getting tight on the world's biggest stage, even if you adjust for perhaps they saw a bunch of shots miss and they, you know, it's starting to get to them, there's a lot of, like, intangible stuff you can adjust for. But by the end of that run, the Warriors were just leaving them wide open because they weren't hitting anything. So they weren't even worrying about three-pointers, and they kept missing them anyway. So I think that it might have only been a 1 in 1,000 chance that this happens. Like, this is the thing I think a lot of people are missing, is that even all the stuff, all the factors they talk about, all those things go into it. This has never happened before in NBA playoffs. Never.
Right.
And there's a reason for that. That this is like, all those other things aside, it's also an incredible stroke of bad luck.
Yeah. And like, listen, the people that are probably making indictments on 3-point shooting are likely to be the same people that come after this every year. Like, they're just people who don't like this, and whatever, they can go to hell. Like, I honestly don't care about those people.
I sort of respect a few of them I've seen who are, because like, there's the argument of, well, the Rockets are shooting a lot of threes, but so do all the other teams in the conference finals. They're all four of the top five 3-point shooting teams in the NBA. And some people respond with, well, yeah, none of them should be doing this, which is like, I don't know how you go there, but I respect that devotion to
the consistency.
Yeah. They're like, well, the Warriors also are bad. Okay, sure.
Yeah, I mean, listen, every team that's won the title since 2011 has had a high reliance on threes. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, it's just the way the NBA is now. Like, either, you know, adjust to it, accept it, or move on to a different sport. Because frankly, like, it's not going away anytime soon. In fact, it's gonna go up as the years progress. Like, the Rockets might shoot like 50 threes a game next year. Like, that's legitimately on the table.
If they can get some more shooters in there,
yeah. Like it's just like, you just have to grow up. Honestly, that's the way the NBA is going. That's the smart way. It's won the Rockets 65 games. It got the Rockets to where they are. Their play style was unbelievably successful. If you're trying to make an indictment on ISO ball, like, I mean, you should have criticized the Rockets earlier in the season when they were doing it and they were winning 65 games. Like, I'm sorry. Like, it's dumb. I just think, like, these people come out of the woodworks every year when the Rockets get eliminated. Like, it's the same. And we talked about this before the playoffs started. We knew this was going to happen. That, you know, when James Harden, Mike D'Antoni, and Chris Paul get eliminated from the playoffs this year, there was going to be this underswelling of hot take artists that were going to come out with pitchforks and, you know, come after their style of play, come after them personally, their careers, whatever. Like, that's just the way it is. I mean, honestly, like, they're never going to get 100% approval rating until they win a title, and it's fine. It's whatever.
Yeah. They won't even then. I mean, yeah, so there are plenty of people who were waiting for, like, oh, three-point shooting worked 98 games, but on the 99th game it didn't. So you got to throw it all away, which is exactly the kind of ridiculous attitude that leads to people believing all kinds of fake things because they saw one report that said it was true, as opposed to 99 that show that it's not. And if you think I'm talking about something, I'm probably talking about that thing. But I was actually surprised by how few haters there have been. The Rockets actually won over a lot of people in that series, more than in any previous series they've played over the last several years. Right, this one week and a half. It was like a week and a half or so that really just converted a lot of neutral people into respecting the Rockets and actively pulling for them. Because they are a credible threat to the Warriors, and that's the big prize here. Look, the Rockets lost their shot to compete in the NBA Finals, which is absolutely devastating, and it happened in a terrible gut punch way. But they did get a prize, and that prize is massive respect. They are known now as a true contender and a real threat to the Warriors. The only real threat to the Warriors. That is invaluable.
You're right. The Rockets gained a whole bunch of respect from people around the league for how hard they competed in this series. And honestly, they checked all of our four predetermined goals before the season. Like, Chris Paul and James Harden pairing worked out swimmingly. They won 65 games. They smacked their first two playoff opponents in 10 games. And they competed hard against the Warriors. Like, all we wanted was those three things to happen. Like, we said that it had to be a six-game series at the minimum. It went seven. So they surpassed that. And they lost game seven by single digits without Chris Paul.
Yeah, it's to the point where, like, lots of pundits, I don't want to say if it's more than half or not, I don't care, it doesn't matter, but a lot of pundits feel that the Rockets probably should have won that series. And that's big, you know? Yeah, it's only a moral prize, I guess, but we're about to head into the offseason where those moral victories actually do matter. They don't get you closer to another win, right? It doesn't go on your standings, but it can matter for who's going to want to sign up with you.
Yeah, and listen, I not only that, I think they gain respect from the Warriors, which we talked about before this series. The Warriors had absolutely no respect for the Rockets. Like, before they played them in this seven-game, you know, slugfest, like, they did not care about this. Like, Draymond Green, especially, was so dismissive to them in the offseason. Like, I mean, we talked about this story, like, when, like, there was this report about, no, it wasn't a report, it was just, like, a catch-up to Draymond Green during the offseason, where people asked him about how he felt about the Rockets, and he basically said, like, they're desperate and they have no chance. Right, like that's how the team's vocal leader felt about the Rockets, and that's how pretty much everybody in that locker room felt about it. They did not going into this series. They didn't expect at all for this to be a long series. I think there are people in that locker room that expected this to be over in five.
Yeah. They did think they were just gonna come in and take it from the Rockets quickly and easily, and
the Rockets
were totally
able
to
them.
Yeah. And they backed it up. I mean, they definitely won't ever admit it to themselves because they shouldn't admit it to themselves. But, you know, the Rockets outplayed them overall. They gave better effort. They had a better game plan. If, you know, we don't know what would have happened if Andre Iguodala was healthy. But, we also don't know what would have happened if Chris Paul was healthy, et cetera, et cetera.
Or Luka Mute. Luka Mute was supposed to be a key cog in this series. We talked about it so much. Right. Luka Mute was supposed to be the Swiss Army knife of the series, and he couldn't even get on the floor because of how bad his shoulder was.
Right, and there's no point in litigating what if. Litigating what if will just kill you and make you miserable. But the important thing to remember from this is that the margin of error was small. That's the important part, that it is completely plausible that that series could have gone the other way.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. They're a legit threat. They legitimately could have won that series. I mean, I think maybe this coming season the Warriors actually might try to get that first seed, right? Maybe they're going to want to have that home court advantage against the Rockets in the conference finals. Maybe they don't want to have a chance of losing a game 7 in Houston when both teams are healthy.
Yeah, I mean, the Warriors did not come out of the series looking great, like, at all. like they won the series, but they might have lost, like, a lot of respect.
Lost a lot of respect.
Yeah, it's because they just completely sleepwalked through the regular season, and, like, they should have won 65-plus games. Like, they should have. This team is too talented to not win that many games. And they just kind of, like, took the Rockets for granted. They didn't even, like, as you said, they didn't even care about home court advantage up until they were about to lose it. And now that, you know, they've come out of this, like, they have to win this finals in four or five games. Like, otherwise, it's just, I mean, yes, they'll have three titles in 4 years, but, like, it's not gonna feel as convincingly of a dynasty as it had before, right? It's just like, no one expected this to be as long as it did, but now that it has, it's like the Warriors, like the Rockets are absolutely on the radar in the coming years. Yeah. You are right.
And here's another thing too, which is we've learned a lot of things about the Warriors that they're going to deny, but are absolutely true. For example, I don't think it's just that they don't take anybody seriously and don't like, and, you know, they have another gear they just don't really need to go to, which I think is sort of true. But at the same time, I think that it's more that their mentality prevents them from doing that. If there was ever a time to be at that higher gear, it was in Game 7 of the conference finals on the road. To say, oh, well, they just don't go hard at the start of the game, right? Like, they just aren't worried about it. Well, they should be. How are they not going to be worried about it? If they do not feel the pressure to compete in that situation, there is no situation that will make them feel the pressure to compete. And that is a problem. We're going to have to start figuring that out, right? Because I think that they're getting layer on layer of bad habits because of how good they've been. That you don't want a team that just plays at half speed in the biggest moments of the year. Who would think this is fine? That's so dangerous.
No, you're right. Like, it's I genuinely felt like they underachieved this season, even though they're going to the NBA Finals, right? Like, it doesn't feel like the Warriors of the last 2 or 3 years. It feels like, as you said, a team that's developed a lot of bad habits. And maybe this is just finals fatigue. Maybe this is just them, like, knowing that they're good enough and, you know, being exhausted from playing, from getting to the finals, you know, 3 years in a row and now the fourth year, and just knowing that they can turn it on in the third quarter and blow everybody out. Maybe it's just that. Like, who knows? We'll never know. Maybe it's this, just Durant doesn't feel like he belongs. Like, he just, like, throughout that series, I never felt like Durant belonged in that series. It felt like he was just implanted in that series. Like, you get what I'm saying? Like, it just felt like, yeah, he was brought in, like he was flown in. It never felt like he's been with this team for the entire season, the entirety of last season. It just felt like he just stepped on the court with them.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, they almost honestly looked more cohesive in the previous season, and I kind of wonder if that's just always going to happen, no matter what, right? Like, if you are that good and you go to that many finals in a row and you have that little competition for everybody else, you are going to have some bad habits. That's what's going to happen. If you don't ever have to try, you're going to stop having to try. People wonder, like, oh, why don't they ever go at more than like 60%? Why would they? Like, if you can get all your work done at your job by going at 60% effort, why would you ever go 100% effort? So, and you practice how you play. I think there's something to be said that the longer this goes on, the more, like, no one is really able to challenge them, the more bad habits they pick up, and the more sort of fatigue they pick up, and the worse it's going to be when they do finally lose, because everyone loses eventually. They're not going to, I mean, unless this whole core gets turned over for like an entire new core of equally dominant players, which I guess we can't take off the table, but we can't expect that. Everyone gets old, everyone loses, and it's going to be ugly when they do.
Yeah, I mean, listen, like, it's really, really hard to make the NBA Finals 4 straight years. Like, it's really, really hard. I don't care how much talent you have. Like, it's just, there's a lot of mental fatigue, a lot of, we know we can do it, so why try? But here's the thing, man. Like, you can go 60%, but what if you go 60% and you lose? Like, what if that happens? Like, what if what happened in that game seven? Like, what if that third quarter never comes? Like, what if you go into the game expecting to turn on the third quarter, and what if that third quarter never comes, and you lose the series, and you end up winning only two titles in 4 years? Like, Zach Lowe talked about this on his podcast. That is not a dynasty, man. That's just no. That's flat out underachieving with the and amount of talent you have.
Yeah, and they absolutely had that door open for the Rockets. Like, that is, and that's a big deal, right? Like, you tell a story when the ball is in the air, as Stan Van Gundy likes to say. It's about how they did it. And they, honestly, the greater expectation should have been that the Rockets win that game. We saw what had to happen for the Warriors to lose it. And yeah, I know if the Rockets hit several threes, then the Warriors probably play differently. But that's super tenuous. They were right there on death's door. They had a real shot to lose that. And that has to be taken into account. They were pushed to elimination. No one else has done that, and they let themselves get pushed out. They can tell themselves, oh, we could have just won this in four or five. Well, you didn't. You didn't, which means you can get pushed to seven games, and you could have lost that. And the fact that this team could have lost is a major red flag for them. And they're probably going to defeat the Cavs easily, but I don't know. I don't know if they're capable of taking that as seriously as they should.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point. I mean, this is the first series that they played more than five games. Like, that's insane. They hadn't played a more than five-game series in 2 years. That's bananas. Like, they just, even last year in the finals, they took easy work of the Cavs. Like, they just stole their lunch money. Like, and this was the first series that was actually competitive for them since they signed Kevin Durant. Now, I know they've had competitive series before signing Kevin Durant, but ever since they signed Kevin Durant, they've just been, like, this is why there's been so many debates of inevitability on Twitter. Like there's, this is, the Warriors with Kevin Durant just feel like an unreachable object. And this year, they were very much reachable, and the Rockets showed that. Like, that's, it's just hard to imagine. And now, like, listen, the Rockets aren't scared of this team. Like, they know that. Like, I bet you in there, every single one of those guys thinks that if Chris Paul never went down, they win this series. There's no doubt in my mind they believe that internally.
Yeah, and it's not crazy to believe that. I mean, once again, you can't know what if. But if you're the Rockets, of course you believe that, and you should believe that. That's absolutely what should be going through their heads, that they know now that they can win this series.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll get into this in the off-season discussion part of this podcast, but I mean, listen, like, they're going to attract a lot of free agents because of this, because of the way they competed this year. And you talked about it earlier, like, teams saw how hard they pushed the Warriors, and they know outside of actually joining the Rockets might be your best shot of a championship.
You'll definitely catch less flack for joining the Rockets and joining the Warriors in general. And in a certain way, doesn't it feel better to, like, unseat the champion than to secure the champion?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, like, it really depends on, like, who the player is, at what point in their career they're going to join this super team, all that stuff. All that stuff really matters, and how motivated they are. But honestly, like, it's really gonna come down to who has the extra assets, like, who has the more exceptions, who has more to work with to sign these end-of-the-bench ring chaser guys. And that might end up being the Rockets, depending on how they play their cards this offseason. And, like, the Warriors really, they really pissed it away last offseason by signing guys like Omri Kasipi, Nick Young, and, like, guys like JaVale McGee were just completely useless in this series. Like, they played a short rotation as well. Like, nobody's talking about that enough. Like, they played as short a rotation as the Rockets because they didn't have, you know, good guys that could play in the series. Their guys would have gotten played out of the series. Like, if they had played if they had played Nick Young more, if they had played JaVale McGee more, that they're just like lunch meat out there on the floor, man. Like,
yeah.
The Rockets have that with Ryan Anderson and Nene and other guys, but those are guys the Rockets signed before this offseason. And those are guys that you know, are coming up on critical off seasons, and I just find it fascinating that both of these teams had to limit their bench, limit their rotations because they're just guys who weren't playable.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing. You know, I'm glad you brought that up. Both of these teams do that to each other, right? A lot of people are talking about, well, why doesn't Kerr or D'Antoni play more players in the rotation? And I don't know. I seem to recall us calling this, right? That, like, these rotations are going to get really short. You can't play a lot of these guys. You can play them against other teams, but it's not just that it's a matchup issue, which it is, but also that you just have to be incredibly good to win against these guys. You can't have any weak links out there. So both these teams have a lot of players who can and do play very well in the regular season, and honestly against every other team in the playoffs. You know, you can get minutes out of Nene in against other playoff games, against other teams in the playoffs, but you can't against the Warriors. You have to go with your best players. You can only play a select few. And, yeah, you want to get as many of those few as possible, but there's just only so much room. You know, you only have so many minutes to give out in the regular season. How are you going to tell a guy who should be a starter quality player that he's going to be the eighth man? That's really hard, and not even the Warriors really can do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the Iguodala injury really hurt them, right? And that's where the Mbamute injury really hurt the Rockets, is that they just had to play short rotations. And I'm just going to find it fascinating how the Warriors and the Rockets play this in the offseason. Like, how they improve their end-of-the-bench guys is going to be really... Like, these teams are now officially in a chess match till death, basically. until one of their franchises folds or gets old and can't compete for titles anymore. Like, they're going to be linked together forever, like the Warriors and Cavs were for the past 4 years. Like,
yeah, it was a one-sided rivalry, but it's not anymore. This is a real rivalry now.
Yeah. And everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. Like, whenever the Rockets sign somebody, it's going to be with explicit intent to play in a Warriors series. And whenever the Warriors do that, it's going to be the same thing in a Rockets series. Like, nobody in the Western Conference can compete with the Warriors outside of the Rockets. Like, that's just the way it is, man. Like, I mean, just look, if you look around the landscape of the Western Conference, like, maybe you could say the Spurs, but I mean, their future is looking really murky right now. And the Rockets are going to be, they're going to have another shot. Like, if they don't face injury, and if they play their cards right, if they, whatever they do this summer, like, they're going to be the most formidable opponent for the Warriors again next Western Conference Finals. And it's going to be a real back and forth thing, man. It's going to be, I can't wait. Like, it's the chess match is going to be really fun. It's going to be all off season, all buyout season. It's going to be a constant back and forth of guys you can find off the scrap heap that can contribute in a Western Conference Final. Like, Gerald Green was somebody who I got to give credit to, because I didn't think he'd be playable at all. But they signed him off the scrap heap, and he was actually a really big contributor for the Rockets in this series. Like, I'm genuinely surprised that he played so much in the series and played well. Like, stood his ground on both ends for as much as Gerald Green can.
Yeah, he acquitted himself well. I think he's definitely the kind of guy you want to keep on your team at a minimum, because he adds a lot of fun and tangible stuff. He is a great teammate. He can absolutely get you a lot of plays and a lot of minutes in the regular season. And yeah, he may be unplayable against a couple of teams in the playoffs, but you know what? That's fine.
And it's worth it. He was playable. In this Warriors series, he was playable.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's surprising to me. Like, and it's going to be a constant back and forth with these teams of finding guys like that. Like, finding guys like Mbamute, finding guys like PJ Tucker, finding guys like 3-and-D wings are going to, like, they're already a prized possession. But with these two teams, it's going to be, I mean, I just can't wait. I can't wait till this offseason starts. So do you want to get into it?
Yeah, we should probably do that a little bit.
Yeah, okay, so apparently, according to Mark Stein's latest newsletter, Chris Paul has already begun recruiting LeBron James. Now, the newsletter is vaguely worded, so I'll just read what it says verbatim, and you tell me what you think. So here it goes. Rest assured that Chris Paul, who made a fast exit from Toyota Center late Monday night, after being forced to watch the biggest game of his life from the bench because of his hamstring injury, has already begun his recruitment to James to Houston.
Yeah, that means he's texting him.
Yeah, I mean, like I just think, like, I can't believe we're already here. Like, I was expecting a good 2 weeks off, but, like, it is Wednesday, and the Rockets got eliminated on Monday, and we're already on LeBron watch. And LeBron's playing in the finals right now. Like, that's crazy to me. Like, it's only been a couple of days since they've gotten eliminated, and we're already in LeBron watch mode.
I mean, if you were Chris Paul, would you wait? You know, what's he doing? He might as well just call him from the parking lot like old Draymond did a couple years ago to call Kevin Durant. Why not? Start now. Let's keep the dialogue open.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this for 9 months, but now it's fully coming to a head, this LeBron watch stuff. I mean, it's the scenarios for which they can land LeBron are like, look, Daryl Morey was talking about this in his exit interview press conference today. He believes, like, I mean, he hinted at this, like, there's, like, he never said it explicitly, but he was asked by Jonathan Fagan, like, and it was funny watching the back and forth between these two in the press conference. Like, Fagan basically asked Morey, like, if you're going to pursue a high value free agent, how are you going to bring all of your guys back? Like, how are you going to bring Clint Capella? How are you going to bring Chris Paul? How are you going to bring Trevor Ariza back? And Daryl basically said, those two things aren't even related. Like, I can make that happen, basically. He basically said that. And I just think that this is, Daryl really believes he can get this done through sign and trade. Like, he really believes he can get the Cavs to play ball. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that if LeBron, for example, if he's the guy, if he does decide that he wants to come to Houston and he's willing to do that extension and trade, that's how it'd have to work. And the difficulty is that it would require like a multi-team trade for it to happen. And a three-team trade is exceedingly difficult in all scenarios. Yeah. But it's possible. It's doable. You can make that trade. It can happen. It just requires, you know, finding. I mean, obviously, the long and the short of it would be you have to move Ryan Anderson and then see what you have to move with him to move him, which would probably be Eric Gordon and some picks or something. So it's out there. It just has to have a bunch of things come together for it to happen. So it's technically possible, not realistically plausible, really. It's not very probable, but it could happen. It's not off the table. And, you know, once we know what LeBron himself wants to do, obviously that's the biggest thing. Because if he comes out and he says, I want to go to Houston, they're going to figure out a way to get that to happen. Where there is a will, there is a way, especially in this world of salary caps.
Yeah, and listen, like, there's no doubt in my mind Daryl's going to be aggressive, like, really aggressive for a third star this summer. Like, there's a report today by Kelly Iko USA Today Sports that the Rockets are going to be in heavy pursuit of Paul George this summer. So, like, there's no doubt in my mind that they're already scouting the NBA landscape. I mean, they've been doing this probably for, like, months now. Like, probably as soon as Chris Paul was added, they already immediately started their hunt for a third star. And, you know, that started with Paul George, and then it moved on to Carmelo Anthony as soon as Paul George was moved. And now they're back on Paul George because the possibility exists that he may still be available. And, like, the difference now between now and last offseason is that, like, there's all this talk about how, man, you couldn't even move Ryan Anderson last offseason. How are you possibly going to move him this offseason? I'll tell you why. First, he has 2 years left on his contract instead of three. That's huge. That's one extra year of $20 million in salary that you're not having to pay for him. Two, the Rockets would be more willing to attach assets to Ryan Anderson in a LeBron James deal than a Carmelo Anthony deal. That's
absolutely.
That's the biggest thing. They would be more willing to give up draft picks. They would be more willing to give up Eric Gordon. They would be more willing to give up, you know, key prospects that, you know, like Zochi or whatever, you know, whatever they have in the coffers. They'd be more willing to cough that up in a Paul George or LeBron James trade than they would a Carmelo Anthony trade. And I feel like that's not being discussed enough because people just assume that you, because you couldn't move Ryan Anderson last year, that you can't move him this year. And I find it hard to, like, if you were to put a gun to my head right now, this offseason, and make a prediction about it, I would say, first, I think Chris Paul comes back. And two, I think Ryan Anderson's not on the team next year. I have a hard time believing that after this postseason, after Ryan Anderson was moved to the bench in January and completely unplayable in the playoffs and basically played garbage time minutes, I have a hard time believing that Daryl Morey is happy with using that roster spot on him and devoting that much cap space to him. Like, I genuinely believe, star or no star, that Ryan Anderson is going to be gone next this summer. I just feel it in my gut. Like, Daryl has never held on to a bad contract for more than 2 years. Like, if you look at Corey Brewer, if you look at Omer Asik, like, those contracts were moved pretty fast after they were inked.
Yeah, he's good at shedding unfavorable contracts. And yeah, Ryan Anderson served his purpose, and he served it well. And he's been good in the regular season, but I don't know. It definitely felt like when he missed some time there toward the end of the regular season that he just got, like, bumped entirely. They were no worse off without him, and they realized it. And so he'd be very helpful for somebody. And he would have been very helpful for the Rockets if not for the fact that you just need a different thing nowadays. I don't know. It's weird that, like, the stretch four seems to actually be on their way out after as quickly as they came in.
Well, the stretch four that can't defend in space, right? Yeah. Like it's really hard to play you. They found it hard to play Ryan Anderson in the Utah series, which I found, like, strange. Like, you would think that with Rudy Gobert out there, like, you'd maybe find a way to play him at the five, but they just couldn't find spots for him. And I just think, like, watching him, it's hard for me to envision a Rockets team that has Ryan Anderson on the roster next year. I could be wrong. I'm just taking a shot in the dark here, but I genuinely believe Daryl will find a way to move that contract, whether or not he brings a star along with him. I just think Rhino's gone.
I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to think. I wouldn't be counting on his presence. I think his salary is a big part of a lot of potential improvements they could make. Like, if they pick up any reasonable player, they're going to have to move his salary to make whatever trade they need to make, sign and trade or otherwise. And it's surprising how many players do have the ability to do that, little sign and trade.
It's an opt-in trade, basically.
Yeah.
You opt into the last year of your deal.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if it's a straight up trade, it's actually harder, right? Like, if you're looking to acquire some talent that is under contract for a few years, yeah, the Rockets don't have the pieces to do it, but they have the ability to sign a free agent by way of trading for him, which is kind of what happens with everybody nowadays. People say, oh, well, you know, what if no one just chooses to take those contracts? Someone always takes them. Man, someone always does. When has that ever stopped anybody?
I mean, the Rockets did this last year with Chris Paul. I mean, when a free agent tells you, I'm out the door, get something for me, teams are more willing to react than if they just leave. Like, or if they just threaten to leave, right? If they're civil about it, you're more likely to get what you want. And both teams are more likely to come to the table if you plan this ahead of time. That's what happened with Chris Paul. Chris Paul went to management in their meeting before the offseason started and said, I'm out. Get something for me. And the Clippers did just that, and they came out with a pretty penny. I mean, they have a nice little collection of talent there. Sam Decker, Montrezl Harrell, Lou Williams was really great for them this season. They got a draft pick out of it. Like, they came out pretty well. And their future looks a lot brighter than it did before the Chris Paul trade, right? And, like, I just think Daryl is really good at constructing deals where both sides come out of it looking really great, especially when a star player is leaving, so you might as well get something for it.
Yep. So, yeah, I do think that it's pretty likely that you're right that Ryan Anderson's gone, but I think also that it's quite likely in that scenario that Eric Gordon goes with him.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. We're not going to get too deep into the weeds because we have a lot of offseason left, man. And
oh, boy, we do, yeah.
And it's going to be – I can't wait. Like, my favorite time of the year is the playoffs on the NBA calendar. Everybody has their pet favorite time of the year, whether it's trade deadline, free agency, whatever. Mine is the playoffs, and right after that, it's July 1st. Like, nothing competes with July 1st after the playoffs. It's just the best. The craziness that goes on social media, like people following certain things and unfollowing certain things, rumors being leaked out to the media about players' wishes, like all that stuff is so fun to get into. I can't wait to get into it with you this summer and other people on the site. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at RedNationOops and at DoNots. Give us a review on iTunes if you enjoy the show. It really helps us out, helps people find the show. And yeah, guys, good night.